only love good things in our interiors, because then we can come into heaven. You can't bring the bad things with you into heaven. It'll create a conflict. It'll make you unhappy. It'll make everyone in the heavenly society you come to unhappy if you bring these evil earthly things with you. So you got to get rid of them. That happens during the second stage. So that's the purpose, is to dissipate the evils that you still carry with you, even though you're a good person. So what's the process? That's on the second and third pages here, is the process before we get into specific fastations. So let's just stick on page two. Page two is a set of passages that describe the fastation process as being a gradual separation for a good person from evils in them and for an evil person from goods in them. It doesn't happen instantly. It happens over time. It's a gradual separation. There's a reference to a liberation from infestations affected successively by degrees. That means it takes time to get rid of those evil things you bring with you that you don't love but are still part of you, after you've gone from a state of merely exteriors where you wake up and you're just like you were on earth to beginning to come into who you really are, obvious for everybody to see. There are many different kinds of vastations. That's the third number here, Arcana Celestia 698. Probably as many vastations as there are people. There are themes and variations probably that occur, and we're going to look at some specific vastations. But if we have some of the problems we're going to read about, we can probably expect to encounter a similar vastation ourselves. And I submit to you that's why we have them. So we can learn about how the vastation occurs if we don't get rid of it by then, in order for us to better understand the evil and get rid of it now, to get that head start. So all different kinds, and then if you turn the page, it tells us about the time period. Now, if you were here for Vance's presentation, we talk a lot about time, and you'll see the first two numbers says, the one from the diary says it can take up to 50 years. That's a long time. Now, there's a footnote by the translator, James Buss. He realized that in Apocalypse Revealed, there was a reference to what he thought were vastations only taking 20 years. His explanation to resolve it was the spiritual diary passage was pre-last judgment, after last judgment. It only takes 20 years. I think that makes a lot of sense. I've looked at both numbers. It's very consistent. And I'm very comfortable going with a 20-year time period. So maximum 30 years in the world of spirits. Worst case scenario, 20 of those years we're going to be vastating for. So at least it's not the whole time. And at least it's not 50 years. Think pre-last judgment vastations as being more than twice as long.
In the last 10 years, you just relax and recover.
Well, I'm wondering what those last 10 years are. That might be the instruction.
The
first 10 years, they're
and then the vastation starts. A lot of time in the exteriors. So it can happen a bunch of different ways, for up to 20 years. It can be as short as a year or less than a year. But vastations often include anxiety and despair. And then, the last number here on page three, they're followed by a sense of hope and consolation, and then enlightenment. And that enlightenment is the beginning of the third stage, the state of instruction. So we're there for however long, getting these evils separated. It's a lot like a temptation where you're pushed to the point of despair and you have anxiety and worry and upset if it's a serious fastation. Not all of them are like that. And then you have a sense of hope provided by the Lord through angels. They console you and you enter into a sense of light and are instructed and then go to heaven. So that's what we're aiming for, is minimize that 20 years, get to that hope, consolation, and enlightenment as soon as possible. So now we're going to get into specific ones, and we'll turn to page four. And I'm going to read this passage, and then I'd like to talk about it a little bit if you have thoughts you want to discuss after I propose some questions for thinking about. This is from Arcana Celestia 1110. Those who have assumed righteousness and merit on account of their good works, and so have attributed the efficacy of salvation to themselves and not to the Lord and his righteousness and merit, and have confirmed themselves in this in thought and in life, in the other world have their principles of falsities turned into fantasies, and that's the archaic spelling of fantasies, so that they seem to themselves to be hewing wood, chopping wood. This is exactly as it appears to them. I have spoken with them. When they are engaged in their labor and are asked whether they are not fatigued, they reply that they have not yet accomplished enough work to be able to merit heaven. So Swedenborg walks up to these people chopping wood. Why are you chopping wood? I haven't done enough work to get to heaven yet. When they are hewing the wood, there appears to be something of the Lord underneath the wood. Thus, as if the wood were merit that they were getting. The more of the Lord there appears in the wood, the longer they remain in this condition. Think up to 20 years. But when that appearance begins to cease, their vastation is drawing to an end. At length, they become such that they too can be admitted into good societies, but still they long fluctuate between truth and falsity. Great care is taken of them by the Lord, because they have lived a dutiful life, and he from time to time sends angels to them. Now, wood signifies good, and these are people who have lived a good life, and they're laboring under this misimpression that I'm going to do good things to get me to heaven. And they have to have that idea separated from them. It's not who they are internally, but it's a false idea that is enough of them that it isn't easily put to the side. It's one that they have to work through because they or us are so wedded to it, but not to the point of where they really love it internally. So what does the Lord do? He has representations of good wood in front of them, and they've got to chop wood and chop wood and chop wood. Swedenborg appears. Why are you chopping wood? Well, I'm trying to get to heaven. And they have to keep chopping. And just picture, I didn't understand vastations, so I did a study in theological school, and that's why I ended up wanting to do it for this presentation, because, oh, they're neat ideas, crazy ideas, really. But no, wait a minute. The Lord gives us everything in his second coming for a reason. There's a use for every single truth he gives us in his second coming. So how can we use this fantastic story to serve the Lord? Well, okay, let's go back to the scenario. You're chopping wood. And the more you think, the more wood I chop, the quicker I'm going to get to heaven, the more this image of the Lord appears below it. And to me, it seems like it's because you think that just by doing this task, not because you're loving to do it for the person whose house is going to be warm, but because of the sense of just accomplishment you get from the pure act, whether it's useful for anybody or not. And so the Lord appears like, okay, once I get through this pile, I'll get to the Lord. And the more you think that, the more that image is there. And then you figure this has got to get to the point of despair, where you're doing it for so long that you're just broken. So picture, you know, the first day. A lot of us have probably chopped some wood or done something similar. Maybe it's like painting a room. You know, the first wall you paint, oh, that looks awesome. Two rooms later, you're sick of it. chopping wood, I think, has a similar effect. The first maybe half hour, and then if you wait too late in the fall, you got to do a lot more at a time. And then picture that over and over and over again, not just for an afternoon, but for the whole day into the night, for another day, another day, and another day, and pretty soon it's gonna. You're there. I would imagine you would like nothing less than chopping wood. And you throw the axe down. You sit down and realize this isn't gonna get me to heaven.
This is what?
Is not gonna get me to heaven. This is not gonna get to me. I thought this was gonna get me to heaven. It's not gonna do it. That idea is broken in your mind, and the Lord sends angels to console you. And then the third stage is about to begin, and you get taught these wonderful ideas that now make perfect sense to you. So if we think about the satisfaction, did you have a question, Pierce?
I was thinking about an example in real life, because I don't think people actually think that they can chop wood to go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I have one I can offer, but if you have one, I'd
love to hear.
Well, how about a soup kitchen? You hear a lot about the writings call them benefactions of charity. You know, that if you go and do something that's helpful to the world, we need to do those. These are good things. But if we do them for the good feeling that we get, so we go to a soup kitchen, to help give people food who need it. It's a good thing, we should be doing it. If we're doing it for the right reasons, yes, that will get us to heaven. But if we just go to do it because we like the delight that you get out of being there and, oh, I feel so good, I'm going to pat myself on the back, that's not going to do it. Now remember, these are vast stations for people who are going to go to heaven, for good people. This isn't a evil that is going to send someone to hell, because otherwise this person is living a good life. But it's the idea that just the act alone, the pleasure you get from the act, is worthy, it will get you to heaven. So I don't know if that's an example that resonates or not, Piers. If you had another idea, I'd love to.
I don't volunteer.
Oh, okay. No. I've done Ronald McDonald House, and it is a wonderful feeling. Absolutely wonderful feeling.
People who are workaholics.
Yeah, that could be. Yeah, I think that's a possibility. Why is it wood, though? Wood corresponds to good. So I think that the activity has to be something that has an element of goodness in it. And the false idea is associated with doing that activity for the sort of the good external feeling you get out of it, rather than the good internal motivation of loving your neighbor as a result. So,
well, I think it's easy, maybe not for a lawyer, but I think for some people it's easy. My job is like minister. Because I'm doing my minister stuff, I'm a good person.
We're going to get to that one. There's a specific vast station. We're going to get that in two more vast stations.
It's interesting. I never made this connection, but it reminds me of the Old Testament law that if you collected wood on the Sabbath day, you would be put to death. And I believe that represents a similar collecting wood on the Sabbath, which is the Lord's day, is taking merit.
I think those people are going to hell.
Yes, true.
if they're going,
it
says they'll die.
It's a spiritual
death,
so yeah.
So the question I think that I like to think about now after having looked at this is, wow, can we catch ourselves in a mind frame where we're cutting wood rather than doing something because we love the person we're doing it for, or doing something because we love the fact that the Lord wants us to do it? So if you want to, for this one, this is what I'll leave you with on the wood cutting vast station. If you want to avoid chopping wood for up to 20 years in heaven, whenever you're doing something good, remind yourself you're not doing it for the good feeling you're getting. You're doing it for your neighbor because you love them, and you're doing it because you love what the Lord tells us to do. And we won't be chopping wood. Maybe we'll be the ones consoling others who do when they've thrown down that axe and hit that point of desperation. Before I move on to the next one, anyone have any other thoughts they want to offer? Andrea?
Is that good feeling you get when you do something, though, immediate good?
It could be.
I mean, eventually you got to get rid of,
sure.
Obviously.
Yeah. I think it really could be. That's what motivates you to do it in the first place. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you can move beyond that, then you won't have to be vastated of the immediate good. Yes, sir?
Maybe the same point, but I think we want to be careful about trying to rush children too fast out of this state. They need to be able to take a certain satisfaction. We need to sort of lead them along step by step.
Right. Shifting
the motivation.
Yeah. Yep. And not try to vastate them.
And in the end, you still end up enjoying it. It is okay to enjoy doing your brother. It's not the reason, but angels are happy.
Well, it's the happiness of heaven, is being useful. It's a result. Yep. But if you try to get it, it's like the false heavens in the beginning of conjugal love. If you go there for the result rather than to be useful, you're going to chop wood. All right. There are three merit-seeking vast stations. And by merit-seeking, I mean doing things for merit because it's good to do them for yourself rather than for others. The second is grass cutters. All right. We've got wood cutters now. We've got grass cutters.
Grass
cutting.
I know a guy like this.
Look at the picture while I'm... Look at this picture... I did a little research. All right, how do you cut grass in the 18th century? Because I wanted to know what Swedenborg was. You got it, exactly. And so it's got a big blade on the bottom. It's a scythe, right? Yeah. And it's a back and forth motion. I think you get like a 3-foot swath. So that's how you cut grass back in the 18th century. So I think that's probably what Swedenborg was witnessing. Today, this bath station, I think, is with a lawnmower and a lawn as far as you can see. And it's a push mower, too. So let me read through it. This is a series of passages in the Arcana. This is the next one 1111. Those who have lived a good civic and moral life, but have persuaded themselves that they merit heaven by their works, and have believed that it is sufficient to acknowledge an only God as the creator of the universe. In the other life, have their false principles turned into such fantasies that they seem to themselves to be cutting grass and are called grass cutters? They are cold and try to warm themselves by this cutting. And that makes a lot more sense if you picture someone with a scythe staying active trying to warm themselves. Sometimes they go round and inquire among those whom they meet whether they will give them some heat, which indeed spirits can do, but the heat which they receive has no effect upon them because it is external, and what they want is internal heat, and therefore they return to their cutting and thus gain heat by their labor. Their cold I have felt. They are always hoping to be taken up into heaven and sometimes consult together how they may introduce themselves by their own power. As these persons have performed good works, they are among those who are vacillated. And at length, after some time has passed, they are introduced into good societies and instructed. Grass corresponds to scientific truth, or memory knowledges is another translation of the same idea. And this was for somebody who thought that, again, good works would get them to heaven. But they had an idea of God, but it was an idea of God in sort of a strictly philosophical notion. Sort of the, I interpret it as the clockmaker kind of God, a deist approach. There's a God, he created the universe, set it all in motion, and now it's up to me to figure everything else out. And so instead of cutting wood, because he just wanted to do good things and pat himself on the back, he wanted to do good things with the knowledges that he had, the scientific knowledges that he had, and this sort of abstract idea of the Lord. And so that's what he had to be separated from. And that was internal coldness, which you can see, that's pretty cold. If you can't picture a divine human God who can wrap his arms around you and give you a hug, the idea of the Lord is not very comforting. So he's got this side and going back and forth in a 3-foot swath as long as it takes for him to throw that thing down and say, this isn't going to do it. And then the process, remember, you're followed by consolation after you get to that breaking point, and hope, and instruction. So we've got woodcutters, and we've got grass cutters. And what's the main difference? Did anyone pick up the main difference? Because you've got merit-seeking grass cutters and merit-seeking woodcutters, but what's the difference? Did anyone pick it up? I'm sorry? Yeah. So it has a different manifestation in what you got to do for long enough to break yourself from that idea. Now, maybe more of us have mowed a lawn than cut wood. And I don't know about you, but when I look back and see nice straight lines, it's pretty satisfying, whether anyone else sees it or not.
I'm with you, Bob.
What's that?
Yeah?
I love it. And it just looks great. No one else has to see it, and I'm really satisfied. But I think that's the kind of thing that we're getting at here. And maybe it's figuring out a math problem, this idea of scientific, oh, that's just so delightful. And I'm great because I strike that long perfect. That's going to get me to heaven. No, it's no, it isn't.
10 cords of wood out there.
Yeah, more than that. 20 years worth of wood, it could be.
I mean, that's so.
Yeah, maybe a lot of this was going on during the Enlightenment. There could have been just as far as you could see, nicely cut. And you can picture it maybe starting to grow again as you look back, the part you already cut, and you've got to get started. I don't know, this one seems like it would last longer than cutting wood because it could stay interesting for longer. So this is our second challenge. If there are sort of mundane things we do that we get a lot of pleasure from and begin to think about it as a kind of eternal reward, then we're going to have to go through something where we separate from that idea before we get to heaven. So next time we're doing something that's just fine to do and good to do, we just got to keep it in order. We're cutting the lawn, well, to make it look nice, but not just for ourselves, for our family, for our neighbors, for the community. That's why we do the mundane things of life, not for ourselves, but for our family members and the community and people we run into, to just keep things orderly. But that doesn't get us to heaven. Just keep it in order in your mind why we're doing it. Yes, sir.
If we take an excessive interest in just studying doctrine as an intellectual exercise, we can go on and on with that, and yet it fails to warm us.
Well, I'm very glad you brought that up. I didn't include the passage. I tried to stick with passages that had multiple references to them or references just from the Arcana. We'll look at one that's from the diary, and I believe there were multiple sort of cross-references for it. But there was one about people who love to read for the sake of increasing their knowledge. And their vastation, if I remember correctly, correct me out there if I'm wrong on this one, but I think they read by candlelight, and the candle continually goes out as they're reading. Do you guys remember that one? Okay. Talk about torture. That one's tough from the get-go, and a little bit more obvious maybe on why that's a way of separating you from being wed to just the delight of reading. But that's a good segue into the next one. All right, so now we've got, Pierce, go ahead.
Sorry, I asked another question.
No, go for it.
You mentioned the idea that this was a deist god.
I think it's one way I'm looking at the first bolded part on here.
Yeah, I'm trying to make sense of it. Yeah. I thought that was a good idea. I was wondering if you had, because that's a distinct difference between wood. Because in the wood bastation, it's talking about the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and here it's merely talking about God.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of people who think that they can regenerate themselves and aren't asking the Lord for help.
Yeah.
Well, if God's up there, he set the universe up. Well, if I just get all the truth out there and figure out what's evil and what's true and good, then I can make myself a better person.
Yeah.
I can do it. Everything's going to be lined up just right, and that's how I'm going to make myself good.
Yep.
And then you get together in small groups at little church camps and say, hey, how can we get into heaven?
Yeah, like these guys are doing.
Ask the Lord.
Yeah, I think it's sort of, you can picture a kind of utilitarian calculus that these guys will get together and set up hypotheticals. All right, you got to train with 10 people on it, train with 20 people on it, they're going at each other, what do you do? Because this was an old law school question, do you get in trouble if you divert one train or not? Anyway. Because 10 people are going to die no matter what. And the question is more or less what's the right moral thing to do. And you can see, I'm going to weigh all these things, but if you don't bring in religious principles, then you're not going to get the right answer. And I think that's the idea with the grass cutters. Whereas with the wood cutters, the Lord's more present there because I think that's the difference between good and truth, really. Good without truth, there's still maybe more presence of the Lord than just truth alone. All right, now we're going to get back to a truth vastation. And this is our last in the trilogy of meriting heaven through good works. This is the water carriers. And I love this guy because he doesn't look too happy here. Another 18th century figure carrying water. All right, the drawers of water. I'll read this one. Those who, without true faith, suppose from the word that they merit heaven from having labored in the vineyard or having preached and taught. This is the one, Pierce, that I referenced a minute ago. And hence, suppose that they merit salvation. They are vastated by corresponding fantasies in the other life, but principally by this, that they seem to themselves to carry water from ponds or from the sea by which they are surrounded and to pour it into a trough so that a flock may drink. When the trough is filled, they rest until they again draw. The trough is filled until the water overflows. It seemed indeed as though a flock would come and drink, but whether a flock does appear to them cannot be confirmed. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't think that flock ever comes to this trough. So water, of course, signifies truth. And this really seems to me like the idea, and maybe this is an occupational hazard, but hey, I can teach all this stuff and really feel good about it, but maybe not be so concerned about whether it's going to help anyone listening go to heaven. I think that's an awful lot like filling a trough full of water, putting out a lot of truth and letting it overflow and sitting down and a flock never comes by, but you fill up your water cans again, fill it up some more, and it overflows again. You do that until you realize, wow, there's no good in teaching unless you really care about the welfare of the people that you're teaching. So this might be maybe the most new church-specific vastation here. Maybe we'll find a lot of, maybe we'll have some company when we go down to the pond and pick up some water and look over. Oh. You too, huh? Yes, sir.
This one sounds like it might apply specifically to ministers.
Yeah, that's why I said an occupational hazard. I think it.
Teachers seem like they're being targeted here too.
Yeah, Katrin, you worried about this one? I know you affect my kids at least. Go ahead, Dr. Baker.
College professors too, and we get the lucky deal that when our teaching gets tiresome, we just do research.
Then you got to worry about the candle.
Really good at it.
Let's talk about laboring in the vineyard, which could be physical labor
yeah.
as well. So.
Yeah, it sure could. And it seems like, though, it's a labor of a religious nature, I think, it seems like to me. I think that's probably a scriptural reference. Could be. Was there another hand, Matt?
Do you have any thoughts on how these things actually get them to the point of recognizing where they've gone wrong? I mean, obviously, it's not just because they're carrying water around.
Yeah.
I mean, my initial thought is that as they're doing this, especially being that they're the world of spirits,
yeah.
they begin to be enlightened with what this all corresponds to as well. Is that
well,
how you see it happening? Or what is
yeah.
it that eventually,
well,
their muscles are getting tired?
Right. I looked at, to answer that question for myself, I looked at it in the context of the process that we're given numbers on how vastations work. It can involve anxiety and despair, which is a lot like a temptation. And then the woodcutter one is actually the most specific of all the vastations I could find. And there's some more numbers on it that sort of have the same theme, but add a little bit here and there. And this is what I think it is, because I think it's sort of a psychological question. How do you get to the point where you're giving up this idea? And I really think it is a point of just complete frustration. This is not working. Because remember, you have this idea. If I just teach, if I do another doctrinal class, I'm going to get to heaven. And so you do the equivalent of that through the correspondential activity, which is as it appears that you're doing, with this thought in your head, that's going to get me to heaven. So, you know, just picture this guy with these two buckets filling up the trough. No one comes. But he thinks, oh, I keep filling it, and a flock's going to come because that's how I get to heaven, because he's got this idea about teaching and teaching and teaching. So he just goes to get more water and fills it up. And I remember 20 years of this. So I think it is pushing a vastation like this pushes us to the point of almost like mental failure. And we're going to get to one that talks about being reduced to a state of ignorance, which then you can be instructed in. So I think that's how it works. And I sort of try to walk myself psychologically through it. And you really have to go to the extreme, I think, to do it. But I think that's why the Lord gives it to us in such vivid ways, is otherwise it doesn't seem like it would be the kind of thing that would make you let go of these ideas. Yeah, go. I could imagine that. Yeah, it makes sense that you'd feel, oh, there aren't any, nothing wrong with it. I don't, you know, look around, maybe see flocks drinking out of other troughs, and then you go to fill those up, and then flocks go away. You know, yeah, I can picture all of these things that would be consistent with what the Lord gives us in his second coming to make it even more frustrating. Yeah, definitely. I thought I saw another, yeah, Brad.
Well, I was just reflecting on these three here and the idea of meriting heaven, that in all the pointlessness of these activities, when you consider, you know, the point of heaven is useful service, helping others, and if you're solely focused on, you know, the mere activities, at some point, when there's no flocks coming, when the grass is cut, when the wood is chopped, and you got to be left asking, well, what's missing? What's
yeah.
more? And it should lead you to ponder that maybe it's the people you're serving that matter, and the Lord, not the task.
Yeah, I think that's got to be the state that we'll go through if we find ourselves doing it. But since we understand that now, let's save ourselves the trouble. I think that's the whole point of our conversation this afternoon. We are really fortunate to be in the position to do this, so that we can do it not for ourselves, but to help others do the same thing. Yeah, Fred.
Even in this life, I think we have to be careful how we judge each other about merit-seeking things. In the church we attended for many years, there was a woman who never failed to tell about the good things she was doing for people and the needs that people had that she was filling and so forth. We keep thinking, good grief, you have to keep telling us about all the good things you've done. You know? But you know, on the other hand, she was bringing out points about needs that people had that she was trying to address. And there was something to learn from this.
Yeah.
And so we had to assume that she was sincere, because she certainly poured her efforts into these kinds of things. But it just sounded so meritorious, seeking.
Maybe we could say, if I said that, I know I'm going to be chopping wood, but who knows what is in store for somebody else.
And we all slip into this. Yep. You know? We want to be sure and tell people what we're doing. It's a good thing.
That's true. All right, so now we'll switch gears a little bit. Those are the three ones that the Lord gives us in his second coming very explicitly in regard to activity for the purpose of meriting heaven. And this one, I stayed away from the more severe ones, and this is sort of as severe as we'll get. But they can be pretty harsh. So I don't want to sugarcoat this doctrine, but I do want to stick with ones that are a little bit more pleasant to think about. And vastations, by the way, for evil spirits are downright torturous in some situations, because they cannot take good things to hell with them. But we'll leave that and get back to ones that those of us going to heaven may experience. Okay, so these are vastations for people, again, who've lived a good life. They're going to go to heaven, but they've ascribed all things in nature, or all things to nature, rather than the Lord. So again, you can think of sort of a secular moralist, someone who we would all maybe make the same decisions on life matters as, but who doesn't do it from God, but just, well, this is the best thing for the world to do, sort of a social calculus. In these places also, they have ascribed all things to nature, but little to the divine. I converse with them, and when the conversation turned to divine providence, they attributed everything to nature. Nevertheless, when those who have led a good moral life have been detained there for a time, they successively put off such principles and put on principles of truth. While I was there, I heard in one of the rooms a noise as if there was some persons on the other side of the wall trying to break in. Those in the room were terrified at the sound, believing that it was thieves. And I was told that they who are there are kept in such fear in order that they be deterred from evils, because fear is to some a means of amendment. So thieves, as far as their signification go, they signify those who attribute to themselves what belongs to the Lord. And so in thinking about this, I asked myself, well, what kind of state are we in where we're worried about our control over everything and forgetting about the Lord's role in things? And it can get really scary in life. You know, are we worried about our budget? Are we worried about our child, our job, our spouse? Things that the Lord has a role in, because he has a role in everything, but we can so easily get caught into a mindset of thinking about how I can go and work on all of these things without the Lord being an integral part of it and really being the leading role in everything that we do and think about. That can get pretty scary when we don't include the Lord. And so the vastation for a state like that is you're in a room and you think people are trying to break in. And then when you get to the point of despair, I think Matthew, to follow up, is like, wow, if I keep thinking I'm in control and can figure out all of this, and remember it says, when it turned to divine providence, the conversation, they attributed everything to nature. So if I can just figure out how it all works, I'll be able to keep these people away. But they don't stay away. They keep threatening you and you keep being afraid. Once you really start trusting in the Lord, I think that's when this fastation ends.
It seems like a good one to use on my kids.
Remember what Stephen said. This is.
In a room and not.
They may use it on you sometimes. Dr. Baker.
This is slightly off the topic, but I think pretty close to ask about. In our little discussion group this morning, we were talking about some of us had friends who were atheists who we thought were good people, as far as we could tell.
Yeah.
And there was sort of discussion, well, you know, can those people go to heaven if they truly are atheists? Now, this passage said people who ascribe everything to nature, which is a common thing that atheists do.
Yep.
So, so this kind of gets back to the question that we never really totally resolved in our discussion. You know, could this person undergoing this thing actually be an atheist, or are they a closet believer but who doesn't believe enough yet, or something? You know.
Yeah.
Can you say something around that?
Well, what I first want to point out, go ahead, Pierce.
Well, I think there are good odds we'll talk about that tomorrow.
Oh, that's going to be covered tomorrow in your?
Not mine.
Tomorrow
afternoon.
Oh.
The Q&A panel.
Okay. Well, I'll give a little bit of a response now. The very big first sentence, end of the first sentence, it says, they ascribed all things to nature, but little to the divine. Little to the divine, that leaves a crack open. I think it is. And I, like you, and all of us here, I'm sure, those of us who we know, those friends of ours who are great people, but profess a disbelief in God, we all hope and really probably believe that there is this little bit that they're still attributing to the divine. There are, I don't have them at the tip of my fingers, but there are passages that say if you don't believe in the Lord and confirm yourself against it, you're in big trouble. So I can't sugarcoat those. So I'm with you if I hear what you're saying, which is, boy, I really think they are attributing a little something to the possibility that the Lord exists. And I just don't see it in anything that I've read yet. Frankly, I might be there myself if I didn't have the writings. Rachel.
Is that opening before, when that happened in the world of spirits? I think that was part of the conversation piece. So is that a teachable time in the world of spirits for that?
Yeah, if there's a space in your heart for that, you bet. Because that's the key. If there's even a part of your heart that you haven't confirmed yourself against that and lived a good life, then you're going to be delighted when you work through whatever you have to work through to get to the point where you're ready to hear the truth.
I wonder a little bit if it ties into the passage we looked at this morning that talks about who are and who are not responsible for their evils in the world. Those who are doing evil things just based, it says, on inheritance or other reasons, the Lord can sort of look beyond that. And I've often thought of atheists in that same category, that there are atheists, I think the passage even said, those who are doing evil things that are truly purposefully acting against good and truth. And I feel like I know atheists that are in both categories, those that are truly acting against God and good and truth, and those who are atheists just, because a lot of religions do bad things or what have you, so.
Yeah, or had a very negative experience with the religion they grew up in or people associated with it.
I can totally imagine good atheists in this category.
Yeah. And I'm hopeful, I'm optimistic that most of the people we're thinking about are going to end up being okay. But I don't know. Yes, sir?
The heading you have at the top of the page, is that part of this quote that they really are people who have lived a good life?
Yep, because, let's see, I'll have to pull it out of the quote.
The full passages do say that.
Yep. I think it's all. This is all of 49:41 and a portion of 49:42, but the heading does include both of those ideas in there. Yeah.
It's interesting that the first two, I think that you got when we started, it talks about the Lord sending angels to them, or introducing them into a society.
Yep.
It sort of has a happy ending.
Yeah.
But after the first two, it doesn't mention anything about happy endings.
Well, I think that's, I don't, that's not because there isn't a happy ending. I think it's just because then, for whatever reason, and there is a reason, because I think there's a reason for everything behind why the Lord gave us what he gave us in his second coming. And we could probably find it from the context of this passage. But if we put this passage together with what we know about the three stages and the vastation process, we know that vastations always include hope and consolation followed by the third stage, which is instruction. So there's definitely a happy ending.
Yep.
And we'll find the same thing in these next passages, in the last two, that there isn't the explicit happy ending, but it's definitely there because it's a vastation. We know in the passages that talk about the process fully.
Yeah, and vastations are bound to come to an end.
Yep, it's the second state for good people who go to heaven. And it's only been 20 years, and at the end of that, you're instructed and go to heaven if it takes that much time. So I'm glad you pointed that out. We've got to keep that in mind as we're working through these things, that it's a difficult part of the process that will get us to heaven. Now, this is sort of a depressing vastation, not that the others weren't too, but I want to include this quote because I can imagine that when you're in that room and you're scared to death because you're wed to this idea that you can figure it all out without the Lord and the Word, and then you're broken down and you probably get a knock on the door and an angel comes in, maybe this is what the angel will tell you. Very different is the case with those who trust in the divine. These, notwithstanding that they have care for the morrow, think of all the things we are concerned about. When you drive home, when you're worried about whatever you're worried about, maybe think about this passage. Still, they have it not, because they do not think of the morrow with solicitude, still less with anxiety. They know that for those who trust in the divine, all things advance toward a happy state to eternity, and that whatever befalls them in time is still conducive thereto. So that's the happy ending, I think, for this vastation, is an instruction and willingness to really believe and see how, yeah, the Lord's in charge. And ultimately, I'll be all right because of that. Okay, now, this is the one that I want to go through, this vastation. It's for people who've done evil imprudently, but not with a clear conscience or from a set purpose. Some people are kept in a middle state between sleep and waking, where they think very little, except when they, as it were awake, which takes place by alterations. And then they remember what they had thought and done in the life of the body, and again they relapse into the middle state between being awake and being asleep. And this way they are vastated. Now, I read a couple more passages on the same vastation to try to get a better idea of it. So from the diary we have, I think a similar vastation would be described as vastations through dreams, perhaps also through brief intervals of wakefulness, where they're barely remembered at times what had been done in their lifetime on earth and what had been done from a rash and evil prompting. But it doesn't involve a torment of conscience. So this is a really pleasant one. You get into the second stage, you're coming into internals, and you maybe picture lying down somewhere comfortable, and you get into a kind of dreamlike state, and you remember, oh yeah, I did that. That was dumb. And then wake up, look around, probably it's getting more beautiful through each one of these processes. It doesn't say that, but that's how I picture it. And then you kind of doze off again, oh yeah, that was really stupid too, and I feel terrible for how that hurt somebody. And then you keep going through that. Maybe this one doesn't take as long, but it's not an unpleasant experience. It's just a, yep, all those things, wish I hadn't done, I can see that I shouldn't have, and I would have been a better person if I hadn't done those things. And then you wake up. Probably not a whole lot of instruction is necessary after this one. And then you go to heaven. So how does this help us? This one doesn't seem like one that could help us a whole lot, because either you're lucky enough to go through this or you're not. But then I started thinking, and it's like, have you ever had an issue? Can anyone not hear me? You want me to wait until the windows are closed?
It's the last station you're trying to teach.
No one can hear. The trough is overflowing.
I can see those people think actually, frankly, by the memory they were maybe couldn't make amends or whatever.
Yeah. Did everybody hear that comment?
They're, you know, tortured by memory and maybe comes back and they get released from these memories of what they've done badly.
Yeah. Mike's saying that it would, if you relive some of these things, there would be some torment of conscience associated with it. It seems like there would be, but here it says in the last passage, but still not so that they are tormented by conscience on account of it. And so what I think that means is that somebody who has enough confidence that they're going to end up okay, and so it's just clear, yeah, I made some mistakes, and I acknowledge them, and I'm done with them. That's hard for me to picture too, because I still am tormented by mistakes that I made. But so maybe this is someone I can't relate to yet. I have more work to do. But that's what it says, so I think it's possible. Yeah.
Convert that person, perhaps. Or maybe they didn't know you did. I can't.
Can you speak up a little bit more?
I can't hear from
that. Why don't you restate what she's saying?
Okay. Joy is saying that it's between you and the Lord, I think, is what you're getting at. Is it, if you're at this point, then you know it's between you and the Lord, and it's not like anything else is going to change. The Lord knows it, and you know it, and there you have it. Is that fair enough?
It's kind of saying, I'm sorry to the Lord. What a stupid thing.
I'm sorry to the Lord. Did you have a comment, too?
Yeah, I was just thinking, I think we get fascinations here when we think about things, even in disciplining our children, that we, of course, can't do anything about, we really go back, you didn't handle it better.
Yeah, I think you're right. Another possible application is, we've got a big decision to make, and we know we're struggling with temptations on what to decide. You know, just the idea of sleep on it. And you wake up the next morning, sometimes you have some clarity. Maybe if you read the word before going to bed, or said the Lord's Prayer, and then you wake up and you have some clarity on it. I don't think that's a fastation, but I think it's something we can learn from how this fastation works, is sleep on it. Let your mind maybe be at rest with the Lord, and you'll get some clarity. Go ahead, Lisa.
I was just going to say that I think when we do something wrong, you know, if we're obviously truly sorry and we repent and not want to do it again, what I understand is that, assuming all that's genuine, God doesn't want us to beat ourselves up. The evil spirits do.
Yeah.
So when we start beating ourselves up, we're really listening to the evil spirits and we're not doing anything useful.
I think it's a great point. If you're at this point, those evil spirits aren't going to be able to approach you, and the Lord's mercy isn't going to allow you to beat yourself up. Remember, you don't get punished. Good people don't get punished. From Matt's presentation, that number, I think that's what you're saying. Is it you don't have to repent for these things. You already have. You just need to acknowledge that you're done with them. And so there's no punishment. And that would be a punishment, it sounds like.
Yeah, you're not feeding into the evil spirits. And it's, you know, it sounds like, oh, really easy. But I think, you know, the whole idea is that it has to be genuine.
Yeah.
And then the Lord's going to want you to move forward and not sit there and beat yourself up.
Yep.
That's
I think you're right.
The evil spirit's happy.
Now, we're almost done. Last thing I wondered about this one. I wonder, can the Lord lead a person through this vastation process here on earth for somebody who's lived a good life, established a good ruling love, but they're in a nearly perpetual slumber, like incapacitated, and in that state due to some physical condition? Maybe we all know someone like this, and I really wonder, are they going through this kind of vastation on earth? You know, an end-of-life stage that seems to last for a really long time. Yeah?
It's also worth knowing that during those days, there is still the implantation of remains and preparation for use in heaven. And that all the sensory experiences that we have, even limited, whether someone has Down syndrome or some disability or senility, whatever, still creates a foundation for an internal use.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of preparation going on.
So if that can happen, why not a VAS station too? Okay, and then we'll get on. Did you want another? No? Okay. All right, then we'll get to the last one because we're at an hour here already. That was quick. Okay, this is a tough one. VAS stations of people confirmed in false principles. It's good though, we got false ideas that we've confirmed that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to hell. So that's kind of good. But it's going to be painful to get to heaven. Those who have fully confirmed themselves in false principles are reduced to complete ignorance, and then they are in obscurity and confusion, so that when they merely think of the things in which they have confirmed themselves, they have inward pain. But after some time has passed, they are, as it were, created anew and imbued with the truths of faith. So what do we have to learn from this one? Well, I don't know if you can think of something that you realized, oh my goodness, I was dead wrong about that. And when you figured it out, it was a punch in the gut. And maybe even thinking about it now, it makes you a little sick to your stomach. I think that's what this VAS station is like, is, and then you feel really ignorant, or at least I can speak for myself, and you're like, whoa, that's how it works? That's what the Lord's saying? How did I not figure that out before? And then you think about the things you did inconsistent with that. Ooh. And then you're reduced to a state where you're really ready to hear what the Lord has to say in that particular area. I think that's how this one works. So how is that useful for us? Because this one, I think this is probably the toughest of them, because in some ways I feel like it's the most applicable. If we can get into a habit of identifying the false things that we've already acted on by going to the Word and listening to the Lord there, to the point where we feel ignorant and a little bit uncomfortable, maybe a lot uncomfortable, and then change our life, I think it'll save us a lot of pain in the second stage of the other world. Like an example, I'll give one that I don't think applies at all, because for this one I think that's appropriate. Like, what if you're a polygamist? A polygamist. And then you find Christianity, not even the writings, but maybe even the heavenly doctrine, because, you know, that happens. It has happened.
Happened a lot in West Africa.
Yes, exactly. And you think, whoa, what have I done? That's going to be a painful experience on this earth. If you've found the writings, know it's the Lord speaking to you there, come across the section in Conjugal Love that talks specifically about polygamy and Christianity, and realize I got to change. And then you start looking around and figure out what you got to do. Boy, would that be better to do here, I think, than live with that danger longer and make it harder down the road. So that's one way to picture it. So how do we do that now? Well, I think it's going to sound like a broken record, although it's the first time I've said it. Go to the Word and listen to the Lord and figure out what He's saying that we're not paying attention to or ignoring. And we can do this here. All right, let's end on a happy note. We got this last passage, and this really captures why we spent an hour talking about this today. It's because we can start doing it right now. And why? Not because I'm saying it, but because the Lord says it in the Arcana. This state, which is that of instruction, is the third state of those who are coming out of VAS station or desolation. For when they come into a state of enlightenment or of heavenly light, they are then in the affection of knowing and learning truths, and when they are in this affection, they are easily and, as it were, spontaneously imbued with truths. Now, when are they imbued with truths? You would think in the second state of the world of spirits after you die. But what does it say? It says, those who are on earth, this happens to, from the Lord's word or from doctrine. The Old Testament, the New Testament, and the writings. But those who are in heaven, this is what we expected, from the angels who perceive nothing more blessed and happy than to teach novitiate brethren and imbue them with the truths and goods which are of heavenly order and thus lead to the Lord. So this is the idea I want to leave you with. We can do this on earth from the Lord's word or from doctrine. Any other Well, it's after 5, and now we got dinner coming up, but I'll hang around if there are any other questions or comments.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I noticed there are people who had gone for merit for good, all these good things, and then at the end, people who had confirmed in falsities. Did you find any example of somebody who was on their way to heaven but had confirmed themselves in evil delights?
Well, I focused on the passages that explicitly involved vast stations going toward heaven.
I just noticed there's falsity here, but no confirming evil.
Yeah. Well, I think falsities lead to evil acts, and so I think that's wrapped up in it. So I think it's implicit within false notions that there are going to be some evils that have been committed that are that you're vastated of.
I asked because you mentioned in polygamy,
yeah,
that if they discover this truth and they realize, oh, all the bad things they've done,
yeah,
it was good that they learned that truth before they confirmed themselves in more of the evil.
Mm-hmm.
Used that.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if they've grown to love the delights of polygamy.
I think
that sounds like more
than what this is. Oh, I see. You're not asking generally. You're talking about specifically in reference to this vastation, confirmed in false principles.
Yeah, I'm wondering, yeah, what about confirmed, yeah, evil delights?
Well, unless you know passages otherwise, I think that if you are confirmed in a false principle, you're going to do some evil things, and that it's another step to confirm yourself in the evils. I'm hopeful that you could be vastated, but I didn't look into that specifically.
I've got something that I'm not sure if it's relevant.
So that's a little bit of a dodge.
And that's the poor fellow who's gotten in the habit of saying the devil.
Ah, yes, yes.
And it's just like a bad habit. It's not something he thinks is a good idea. It's a familiar expression, and he has this being wrapped in a veil or a sack. So he's sort of suffocated. It sounds like a bad station.
Yeah.
And it's just because he has a bad habit.
Yeah. Well, and then if we look at the more general passages in the very beginning, it does say, before people can be taken up into heaven, if you look at the very first page, 698, their evils and falsities must be dissipated. Now, it doesn't say confirmed evils. We know confirmed falsities can be dissipated, but I think if there are evils that are confirmed but not ruling, I don't know. What do you think?
I think so too, but I didn't see any examples of it. That's why I was hoping that you had some.
Well, that sounds like a homework assignment.
I was hoping you'd do my work for me.
No, I mean homework for me.
Oh.
I'm still the candidate here.
You know, if you're practicing this.
It is interesting to consider, though, the teachings that the beginning of some sort of repentance, if you have confirmed evil, does have to start in this world.
Yeah.
That's a whole other topic.
Yep.
The question just got me thinking about, yeah, that. There's always the chance of changing and rooting out evil, but there are those very powerful and cult-type passages,
yeah,
that says, this is the world where you've got to start, though. And I thought there's one great passage that says, if you have, man, hasn't made a start of it in this world, you can't get rid of it in the next.
Yeah, it's in the Reformation chapter.
Yeah, I'll look into it. Kurt.
Brett, before we break up, I want to thank you very much for your presentation and for the way you gathered the passages together. The understanding when it's based on the direct passages from the heavenly doctrine is really aided. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And I just would add as a translator that another way that the word vastation can be helpfully and legitimately translated as purging.
Purging.
And if you want to keep that in mind when you think of vastation, it's a purging.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.